The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And while the best league in the world gears up for a restart this week, what's happening elsewhere? The Championship returns, but are they ready? It's fractious in League One as points per game really divides teams between those it benefits and those it really doesn't. In the women's game, were the FA right to stop things altogether? And just how many of those teams and lower leagues men's teams will survive if fans can't return next season? We'll give you the European classified results, all that and your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. All right, so I really wanted to talk about the EFL and the women's game before the Premier League started and those conversations basically get lost. With me for the duration today, Holly Carruthers. It's Faye Carruthers.
Hello, Max.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. It's good to see your face after so long.
It is nice to see you too. Flo Lloyd-Hughes joins us as well. Hey, Flo.
Hey, how are you, Max?
Excellent, thanks very much. Ali Maxwell from Not The Top 20 podcast joins us for the first half. Susie Rack will come in for part two. Ali, look, I know pre-planned substitutions are always dangerous. And if you have a blistering first half and one of Flo or Faye is off form, I may change things at half time. But happy birthday to you, Ali.
Thank you very much. I wish the bishop well.
That will mean something to a very few number of people, but I'm pleased about it. Right, let's start with the Football League then. They had a big day of votes and decisions on Tuesday last week. League One and League Two voted to curtail the 2019-20 season, apart from the playoffs, with the table being decided on points per game. So that meant in League One, Coventry and Rotherham were promoted to the Championship, Tranmere, Southend and Bolton relegated. Wickham climbed into the playoffs in third place, having been eighth when the season was suspended, and Peterborough United dropped out of the top six. And I will take away any Cambridge United gloating about Peterborough dropping out for that. Question one, Ali, was it the right decision?
Well, there were quite a few decisions over the course of the day. I think we knew leading up to it that in terms of whether they would complete the final regular season games, we were aware that the Championship was sort of full steam ahead. That had become clear, and that they were able to swallow the cost of regular coronavirus testing and the cost of not getting any matchday revenue from fans and having the turnstiles clicking. But in League One and League Two, that was clear early on, was going to be really, really difficult. There were so many different figures of sort of estimates of how much it would cost teams if they were forced to play the last nine games of the regular season. And in the end, yeah, League One and League Two both voted not to finish it. I guess the question is, was it the right decision to finish it on points per game? You have to bear in mind that the way the EFL regulations work is everything has to be voted on by the member clubs. Confusingly, you need a majority of all 71 clubs, as it is at the moment, or 72 next season, and a majority in the Championship, which no one's quite sure why, but is kind of to keep them sweet because they're the big dogs. And so this was a vote. The problem is that it became clear early on that the clubs who were voting on this were maybe understandably just voting based on what suited them the most. So you kind of come back to the whole way of doing this. Is it the right decision to vote on something where you're not really voting on merit, you're voting on what suits you best? I think that there was a lot of talk of widening the playoffs, maybe trying to get 9 or 10 teams in the League One playoffs, because part of the confusion there was that there are so many clubs within about 2 points of each other. I think from Rotherham in second to Wickham in eighth, maybe 1 or 2 points. That was kind of really the base of the issue. For me, it was the right thing to do not to expand the playoffs. It was probably the right thing to do not to try and develop some sort of complicated algorithm based on underlying performance data to decide who would have done what if you were able to carry on. And I certainly think it was the right decision for League One and League Two clubs not to play on for the most part, because realistically that could have been very damaging for a lot of clubs. So there are certainly some that come out of it on the wrong side of things. I'm sure we'll get into that. There's a couple of clubs like Rotherham who are probably feeling pretty fortunate. They were there to be shot at, it's fair to say, but they get an automatic promotion. Ultimately, I think it was something had to be done and it had gone on too long. And I think the best thing for me is that we can kind of all start to move forward now, because I think there are bigger questions ultimately to answer over the next few months in the EFL.
Yeah, we'll get to those bigger questions. Big fan of bringing up EFL regulations. I'm surprised there isn't an EFL regulations pod just of its own.
I'm not sure everyone, and there's no reason why you should, know that it's the clubs that vote on these things. So the EFL cannot play God and just decree that you will finish the season or we will end the season this way. So the proposal that ended up being passed was the EFL's own proposal. And there were five or six clubs who were able to propose their own proposals, which is why it ended up taking so long and getting to the point where they wouldn't have been able to restart the regular season games anyway, because there simply wasn't any time. So it was all a bit of a mess. I don't necessarily think it's the ideal way of governing, because it doesn't necessarily feel like the decisions are being made in good faith. At the same time, if the EFL, who are not always that popular with clubs and fans anyway, decided that they were going to take charge and tell everyone what to do, that would have caused absolute chaos as well. So, I mean, I'm not an expert on these things, but it seems like you couldn't really win whichever way you go here.
Who should we feel most sorry for, Flo?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who lucked out, a bit like Ali said. I think, yeah, Peterborough was short done by, and I think Tranmere as well have a right to be pretty frustrated, because they were on a fairly decent run trying to avoid relegation in League One. And obviously Mark Palios had famously put forward his alternative PPG, which kind of looked at what happens towards the end of the season and all the kind of craziness of results, which I think is a fair point. But I know George mentioned on your pod, Ali, the fact that, well, you can't really take into account previous seasons because this is, you know, this is a one of a kind. And, you know, it seemed like Mark Palios even reflected afterwards that, like Ali mentioned, you know, everyone just does end up doing it out of self-interest in their votes or club allegiances that may have existed in the past, relationships with other chairmen, owners, whoever it may be, come into account as well. So although it's fantastic to have the democratic vote, it does mean that it's a little bit kind of, oh, I owe you this from last time. Like, don't forget that, you know. But I think there were lots of people that lucked out. I think there were a lot of people who had agendas for a big playoff, Sunderland, Ipswich, etc. But I think AFC Wimbledon were like lucked out to stay up in League One, because they were always on the edge. And I cover them a lot for BBC London, and I'm glad they didn't go down. But I think, you know, they're probably pretty glad they didn't have to play the rest of the season. Tranmere, Peterborough. Yeah, the unlucky ones. But I think, like Ali said, you know, it was going to rumble on forever. So someone had to come and intervene, because otherwise they never would have found an end to it.
I think the thing that sums up the misfortune of Tranmere is that they were not allowed to keep playing football matches in order to achieve their goal, which would have been to move up one place to avoid relegation. But there are four clubs in the playoffs who are able to play football in order to achieve their objectives. That, among some other reasons, I think is probably the hardest thing to stomach for Mark Palios and Tranmere and their fans.
Well, Barry Fry was very unhappy. And look, Peterborough, it is rough, because they could have easily got automatic promotion. I'm sort of delighted they didn't in a tribal sense. But Barry Fry saying, you can't just dish out PPG willy-nilly, which, let's be fair, they did do it across the board, right? They didn't just go, oh, you have some points, you don't have any points. Faye, your feelings on the matter?
Well, yeah, you can't do that. I think Darren McAntony as well from Peterborough called it a shit show. And, you know, you can kind of see that point of view. I personally think exactly as Ali said, they're damned if they did, damned if they didn't. It's a really difficult thing to decide, and nobody can take a completely dispassionate view, and that's what I find very difficult to stomach when it is the clubs voting on that decision, because it is, you know, I think it was Mark Palios who said he had so much support and empathy from other clubs to their plight, but then no vote afterwards, you know, and that's great. You can pay lip service, do whatever you want, try and keep on good terms with your fellow owners, etc. But at the end of the day, it's the vote that matters. And I do find that quite difficult. I also, exactly in the same vein of form, that Tranmere needing one place, whereas the playoffs, you look at Wickham jumping from, what, eighth to third? And you just think, but I mean, I think there was something like 3 points that separated seven teams in League One. League Two is much easier in a way. It was a much more straightforward table. But League One just wasn't at all. And in that case, you kind of sit there and say, okay, so how many clubs are saying that they cannot afford this and this would be financially crippling? How many clubs are saying they can and they want to go forward? And where is there some kind of meeting in the middle or some kind of funding available that would enable the rest of those games to be played, or the teams that want to take part in the rest of those games and almost have like a mini season, if you like, with the teams that do want to try and see how that would resolve. But I mean, it's really difficult. I don't think there was ever going to be a good outcome.
We are very critical on the pod of football's governing bodies a lot of the time because they don't always do the right thing. But I think, you know, if you're pottering along through a season and then a pandemic comes in and you've got to try and work out if Wickham should be in the playoffs or not, you know, it's not the most important question in the world, but B, it's impossible to get a situation that suits everyone. As you mentioned, Faye, League Two, did League Two just work because it just happened to work? You know, in terms of teams lucking out, it just kind of everybody was where they were meant to be, kind of thing. And then you've got this thing at the bottom where, because Bury went out of business, that Stevenage don't have to go down, so no one's really unhappy in League Two.
Well, they are, because you've still got Macclesfield's situation to resolve. You know, they've got a points deduction potentially coming, and that's going to change a lot of things. And that, again, that, I mean, that's a problem in the Championship. If the Championship games don't end up, you know, playing out, if we have another spike of the virus for some reason and they have to use a system like that, you've got the likes of Birmingham, Derby and Sheffield Wednesday who still have FFP issues ongoing that haven't also been resolved. And this is where, you know, the EFL do need to do something about this, because there's still a lot of uncertainty and people cannot prepare for the next season. You know, I know we're going to end up talking about players' contracts and things, but there's a lot still to be resolved that haven't been. And I know it's a very difficult and unprecedented time, as we all keep saying, but they do need to really start to think about how this is going to play out. And for that reason, part of me, you know, and I'm genuinely not saying this because I'm a Luton fan, I promise, because I'd much rather play out the season and stay up, you know, legitimately. But you kind of sit there and think, there is a little bit of an argument for null and void with a lot of this, because there's so much complication around it that someone's always going to lose out. And yes, people would lose out if it was null and voided because they wouldn't be able to be promoted. And obviously with clubs like Sunderland, etc., putting in so much money to try and have that promotion, that would affect that. But there's a little part of me that thinks that could have potentially saved more heartache in the long run for some of the smaller clubs, perhaps.
It's interesting that, you know, we've been calling League One the naughty middle child because it was just causing so much of a ruckus, whereas League Two was kind of the goody-goody that came together quite a long time ago and said, we definitely don't want to play on. And there were a few teams that could have kicked up a bit of a fuss, a la Peterborough, shall we say, like Port Vale, who are only 1 point out of the playoffs. But there was they got a lot of kudos for essentially taking the wider view and saying, well, actually, we think it's best for the league if we don't play on. The clubs in League Two, more so than League One, are concerned about the cost of playing matches behind closed doors. So they were pretty united in not carrying on playing. But there's also this idea that loads of clubs in League One wanted to keep playing. In reality, only 4 out of the 23 voted to play on. So it's a large majority that didn't. And in League Two, only Forest Green wanted to keep playing and 23 clubs didn't. So it's maybe not quite as clear cut as League One was a massive mixture and League Two was very uniform. Actually, I think just there were a couple of clubs in League One who were making a bit more noise or maybe getting a bit more press than those in League Two.
The most important question is really about the survival of these football clubs, isn't it? Because Bury went out of business and a lot of us went, this is a disaster. We talked about it for a couple of months, 3 months, and then football carried on and we forgot about it. But for those Bury fans, they're still out of business, right? Or they're trying to start their Phoenix club. The Blackpool owner Simon Sadler said, quote, I think clubs will go like dominoes. There is a very serious question about how many League One and League Two clubs will fold, right? If they have to start the season behind closed doors, or even now the financial situations they're in. You mentioned, you know, the issues at Macclesfield. Ali, who is most at risk?
I don't know the finances of every club, Max. And actually, football clubs...
what are you here for?
Football clubs are famously unforthcoming with their finances. You know, they only have to release yearly reports yearly, and sometimes they obscure certain things, that there are loopholes, which means that it's very difficult to get a true picture of a club's finances. Of course, a lot of it comes down to how deep the pockets of the owner are. And I don't know the net worth and the cash reserves of all of the owners either. So it is difficult to just chuck a name out there. I mean, there are clubs who even before the pandemic were late with wage payments, who appeared to be struggling with cash flow, like Macclesfield, who we've touched on, who have been deducted numerous points and might be deducted some more. I think it feels like, not just for football clubs, but business in general, it feels like September is going to be a gigantic month. And I think a lot of that is down to the ending of the furlough scheme. There's probably a feeling that the furlough scheme has been great for businesses, but might not have been that involved with football clubs, because we think of clubs as so rich. And in the Premier League, of course, most clubs didn't need to make the most of that scheme. I'm pretty sure every club in League One and League Two has taken advantage of that scheme. And that's partly why they've been able to just sort of coast along for the last, however long it's been, 3 months or so, when they haven't been getting any of that sweet, sweet gate money that they're so dependent on compared to the teams at the top. So if the furlough scheme ends, they have to start paying their staff full whack, and they are still not getting money from fans coming through the doors, which for a lot of them represents 70-80% of their revenue. It's not hard to see where the problem will come. Now, even before this crisis, we had something of a crisis of unsustainability at this level, and for the most part, owners just foot the bill. But you have to start wondering, if everyone's going to be massively affected, for how long can an owner foot the bill, and what happens when they can't foot the bill? That's going to be the domino effect if and when individual owners think, actually, I could probably do without putting £1 million every month into a club that can't make any money. That's going to be the issue ultimately.
The furlough scheme's been particularly useful for football clubs because they effectively managed to freeze their losses for a short amount of time. And I think that's also what, you know, a lot of them didn't want to come back, is because if they did, they would need to take players and staff off furlough and then lose out on that scheme and start paying out again, not even including the testing. So I think that was a big barrier for them. And then also, you know, there was a report from Deloitte that came out last week saying that, you know, gate revenue for the whole of the Championship is about 165 million. So that could be, you know, a potential black hole for that league next season. I know over the weekend there was kind of talk about a national league having a proposed 25% attendance for next season, because obviously for national league clubs, they literally can't survive without gate receipts. So they were proposing this sort of 25%, you know, spread across the stadium. And someone had done a really great kind of spreadsheet where they'd sort of estimated the losses. And for someone like Dulwich, it was going to be about 12 grand a week. So if that's how, for someone like Dulwich in the National League, I mean, for a League One or League Two club, that's huge. So you've got this, half of it, you know, is, well, how can we, you know, say this season's over when we don't even know when next season's going to begin? But also, if we want to begin next season, how can we even begin it if we don't know where the money's going to be coming from? But with the Championship, it's much easier to say, let's press through, because you've got someone like Sky saying, well, we want to press through because we've got TV to show. Whereas with League One and League Two, you know, that isn't such a kind of demand. There isn't such a kind of pressure to have that come through. So with League One and League Two, you think, well, if you're really going to come back, it has to be without the furlough scheme, and it has to be with fans coming through the door. But how many fans are going to be allowed? Are there going to be any fans allowed at all? And no one really knows yet. I think they've been given a 3-week window in September to try and get things going within that kind of middle to late September window. But no one knows whether fans will be allowed in. I know in you know, New Zealand, they've already got big stadiums full of fans, but obviously it's a much smaller country. I think only 22 people died. Everything's handled very differently around the world. So really, realistically, in September, are there going to be fans at football grounds? I don't think so.
And if League One and League Two don't start at the same time as the Premier League and the Championship, that's the sort of really concerned murmurs at the moment, is will the Premier League and the Championship just leave them behind ultimately?
Even before the pandemic, right, there's been discussions about whether 92, I mean, I don't know how many, probably 100, if not, a lot of the National League are professional, aren't they? Is it sustainable in a country of this size? But there needs to be some really big questions about how you sustain League One and League Two football clubs because they matter to people, right? They matter to communities. That they're central parts of some smaller towns in this country. And there are talks of things like regionalization, salary caps. Are any of these things realistic? How do you make them happen as well?
I get frustrated with the idea that it's just the number of them that's the problem, because that's not the problem. And as you've said, each club, whether they have 5,000 fans or 50,000 fans, means a lot to those fans, and they will pay to go and watch them play. The problem is not the number of them. Part of the problem is the money at the top of the game is so absurd that it sort of creates this gambler's mentality in the leagues below that means you have this ridiculous situation, which is the biggest issue in terms of sustainability in League One and League Two, where a club spends 80% of all the money it makes on their playing staff, the player wages. And that is like just terrible business practice. Like, I know it's boring to keep mentioning the word business when we're talking about football, but you can't just ignore the fact that they have to run sustainably or have a person give them tons of money each week just to keep going. So the biggest issue for me is not regionalization and the cost of travel, which is a pretty small expense relatively for these clubs. And I think the argument that having more local games would mean more fans through the door, I'm not sure that necessarily flies. And I don't think it's the big issue. The big solution is to reduce the amount of money that teams are spending on wages comparative to their revenue. So that's why the salary cap idea has gained a lot of momentum. The problem is that do we have much faith in the ability of the EFL, let's say, to oversee a strict salary cap? One thing we know about football clubs is they love to find a loophole, and they're pretty good at finding a loophole. And so this would have to be very strictly policed, very strictly managed. Like, you'd need to be forecasting all the time, wouldn't you? Because revenues change. You might sell a player for 500 grand. So it's going to be very tough to police, but it's also absolutely necessary in order to bring clubs as a whole to a more sustainable point. There's no reason why 1,000 professional football clubs couldn't exist if they were run sustainably. And that seems to be the issue for me. But again, they'd have to presumably vote on this. How many clubs would want to vote to restrict themselves and what they could spend on player wages? You know, maybe the virus has made some people think a bit more about that, but there's still going to be tons of people who are like, the counter argument is always, well, how can you restrict the ambition of a rich owner? I'm like, well, that's not my priority, to be honest. We've got big questions about the game in general, and we kind of need to address that. And if it means we're restricting the amount of money that one or five or 10 owners can spend trying to win promotion to the championship, I mean, that's fine by me.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not a business-minded person necessarily, but none of it is sustainable. You know, why you see owners coming in and wanting to own a football club, and I'm just thinking, well, you're just going to hemorrhage money. It's crazy. Why on earth would you want to do that? And the biggest problem is that these are community clubs, as you say, but they do have to earn money. And it's like having a corporate model in an area where you need social responsibility. And when you see what's been going on recently as well, you know how much more important community is and social responsibility is. And clubs tend to be at the heart of that. You know, I live in Wimbledon. AFC Wimbledon have been absolutely phenomenal in the local area with what they're doing. We cannot let these clubs fall by the wayside purely on a money basis. And salary capping, for me, I'm all for that, without a doubt. Again, as Ali says, how exactly is that going to be governed and looked after? You know, the EFL have done lots right, but they also have done lots wrong, and, you know, are not necessarily as strong leadership wise as they should be. And, you know, I feel that they have to be better. So how exactly are they going to look at that? But it has to be the whole model. I can't remember who said this earlier. It might have been Flo, that we are very much in danger of League One and League Two in particular being cast adrift. And it's important, you know, so much talk about this football family. It doesn't really feel as if it fully exists.
We talk a lot about, you know, money trickling down from the Premier League, and they have a responsibility, and maybe they do, but I have not heard anybody come out with an answer for that as to, you know, why Bournemouth should help out Scunthorpe. You know, like it's a really nice thing to say to sound like caring. Really, there's so much money at the top and it needs to fill it down. But how do you actually do it?
I think that this, you know, lots of people have looked at the Premier League, you know, and I know we're going to talk about women's football later, but the WSL and the FA included with that. Lots of people looked at the Premier League and said, come on, guys, help us out a little bit. When you look at other sports, so for example, Rugby League, which had a government bailout, each club's getting about £1 million. They needed that, otherwise the sport would have completely collapsed. Also, you know, we know the government were supported by lots of votes up north. So, you know, they need to show some love, if you like, to that part of the country. But there's no more of that coming. There are no more government bailouts for sport. That's your lot. So if there's not any money coming from the government, then who's going to hand it over? The FA, they're effectively a grassroots body. Yes, they have the FA Cup. Yes, they have England internationals to get money from. But essentially, they need to worry about grassroots football as well as women's football and WSL. So they can't necessarily be handing out loads of cash. So the Premier League, although they are their own, you know, entity and their own beast, I do think they do have some responsibility. And I know they do give out your money every year, but now is the time really to look beyond that and kind of work out a way to give some kind of trickle-down payment. I don't know how you would classify it.
I think the concern there is what some clubs would do with it. So you could trickle down that money and there will be clubs that use it the right way and there will be clubs that use it the wrong way. And that's where something has to be done to prevent that.
To give it with some caveats.
I don't think we've mentioned the phrase parachute payments, but it feels like a good time to talk about that because, as Flo mentioned, the Premier League gives £350 million downwards per year. But the way that it's split up, I mean, it always seemed a little bit odd, but now in the current climate, it looks very odd. £250 million are given as parachute payments to clubs relegated from the Premier League. What that means is this season, £250 million was given by the Premier League, split between 8 clubs. Then there's a £100 million pot of solidarity payments, which went to the other 63 clubs as it was this season. So let's say the Premier League don't want to give any more than £350 million. Could we find a way to change the way that they're divvying that up? Yes, it would hurt.
Distribute it more evenly.
Actually, if you split that exactly evenly, you save basically every League One and League Two club, don't you?
That's your maths, not mine, but probably, yeah, genuinely, it's a lot of money. But, you know, Cardiff and Fulham, £42 million each in a parachute payment. Now,
And parachute payments have shown not to work as well. I mean, you know, the QPR being a prime example of that is that people just chuck the money down the drain. You need to control it.
Can I talk about the players and the impact on the players? Because there are lots of League One and League Two players, what, 1,000+ out of contracts, reducing wage bills. We're talking about salary caps. So we don't often think about, you know, their lives and their anxieties. But there must be a lot of footballers now who don't know what's going to happen in September.
Yeah, the PFA did a survey the other day. They represent the players. I think they spoke to a few hundred. There is a very big spike in anxiety and feelings of uncertainty amongst players. And as we know, actually, there are a lot of mental health issues that come from being a professional sports person at the best of times, if I can use that phrase, by which I mean pre-coronavirus issues. Everything we've spoken about, loss of revenue, salary caps, how does that impact a football player? Well, it impacts a football player in the sense that they're either going to be out of contract and all of a sudden the employment scenario is hugely changed, because if you're a club that needs to reduce your payment on player wages by maybe 70% if you're not clear when you're actually going to get that big chunk of your revenue back through gate receipts, you just have to be cutting and cutting and cutting. So if you've got players out of contract, what chance that you're going to offer them a new contract? Probably quite slim. What chance that if you do offer them a new contract, it's going to be on the same terms? Probably even slimmer. So if you're a player out of contract, not only are you looking at a scenario where most clubs are looking to probably sign very few players, certainly not as many as normal, And if you do get signed, it's probably going to be on a lower wage than you were on before. And you can't, you know, no one saw the old global pandemic coming. There would be guys in their late 20s who have been professionals for 10 years and probably have been forecasting another 5 to 8 years of similar wage. And that's just not going to be the reality for them. So does that have a knock on mortgage payments, which I'm led to believe for football players are often a lot higher and shorter term because they know they have this weird career, which is normally done when they're 35. For many of them, they'll be out of contract in a matter of weeks and they won't get a new contract immediately. How long do you wait? How long do you stay unemployed with so much uncertainty?
I understand that, but that's across the world. It's not just, I know sure. We're talking on Guardian Football Weekly, but you know, there's going to be people that are not sympathetic because they don't understand. There's no parity of wages. There's no direct comparison. And I think it's really difficult because yes, they are employees and have contracts, but there are so many people who lost their contracts at the beginning of this pandemic and have not been paid throughout this whole past 3 months. And so this is the situation we're in. And unfortunately, there is, I don't use this word loosely, by the way, there is collateral damage, you know, and I genuinely don't use that phrase loosely at all.
Can we talk about the championship coming back then? Are the clubs happy to be coming? Are they happy to be coming back? Are they happy to be doing it as quickly as they are? I've certainly heard some people in the championship saying we're coming back too soon. We haven't been training as much as the Premier League clubs have.
I think QPR were the most vocal on this pretty quickly. And I think Lee, who's expected more people to come with him on that, he said quite quickly that, which I'm surprised at because, you know, Ali's talked about how democratic the EFL have been with their decision-making so far. But Lee Hu said, you know, they only found out about the return date the night before, which I'm very surprised about. But he was pretty cheesed off. And, you know, Warburton and others within the football club backed him on that. But they seem the most vocal about this. The others seem to think it wasn't too bad. I think just like the Bundesliga and other leagues that have come back, we're going to see injuries. We're going to see them pretty quickly. And I just hope that, you know, they're not really serious ones. But this is, you know, this is the reality of the situation. And I know QPR have a couple of players who won't be returning because they are out of contract and they don't want to sign a new one. So squads are also going to be thinner. So it's going to be really tough for some clubs to even finish the season with a squad that's, you know, fit and healthy, and, you know, people are going to be digging really deep into their kind of, you know, under 23s and their youth sides because they're not going to have many players left. And it's a hard one, especially for the teams that don't really have anything to play for, because it's kind of like, yeah, you know, why are we doing this?
Although there's still stuff to play for. It's, you know, it looks very much like, barring something crazy, Leeds and West Brom will go up automatically. Pretty much three of the playoff spots, Fulham, Brentford, Forest, look assured. And at the bottom, you'd say Barnsley and Luton are pretty much down. Or am I reading too much into the league table?
You're reading too much into that, Max.
I think some people may regret their decision to come back because this is a very strange scenario to play in. You know, I know in the Bundesliga we've seen a pretty clear home and away percentage of wins, but in Bundesliga 2 it's been very different. So these are very strange circumstances to play in. So although people think, yeah, you know, it'll probably just play out, actually, with no fans, with injuries, with, you know, smaller squads, we could see some pretty weird results happening. Also, people aren't probably going to be staying over in hotels. So say you've got, you know, I know QPR have got some trips up north. They're going to have to come back in the same night. Players are going to be really tired. You know, you're not going to have the same conditioning and kind of, you know, looking after the players as well as they would have been. So there's going to be knock-on effects here. So although things, you know, likely to play out, there could be some surprises and things could start to get a bit weird.
But there are always surprises in the Championship, though. It's the most bonkers league anyway, so.
That's why we love it.
At the top of the show, Max, in your excellent intro, you said the best league in the world returns. And I thought it was going to be a long-winded gag about the Championship, which is objectively the best league in the world. No, I mean, West Brom are 6 points clear of third. but they have to play Fulham, who are third, and Brentford, who are fourth. So, you know, that sort of thing can change fairly quickly, just using them as an example. No doubt Leeds have got some tough fixtures as well. The relegation battle looks the juiciest, I suppose. But I think in general, as Flo said, Lee Hughes was definitely expecting a bit more backing when he immediately came out and said they were appalled by the... I think it was more the messaging and the communication of the EFL rather than the decision. But ultimately, this league is full steam ahead, for better or for worse. I mean, one of the managers tested positive for coronavirus last week, Michael O'Neill at Stoke, and everyone just went like, oh, that's a shame. Well, let's keep cracking on, though. You know, you just quarantine yourself, we'll be fine. So, I mean, they're so tied to the Premier League. They're obsessed with being tied to the Premier League, basically for financial reasons, that... You know, they're just gritting their teeth and they want to get through it. But 9 games in 33 days is a hell of an undertaking.
Finally, Faye, did Luton announce their manager on Zoom? Didn't they have all the players on Zoom and then Nathan Jones just popped up again?
Well, it's been touted for a little while. I spoke to Nathan when he was appointed again.
You were on Zoom with him.
I was on Zoom with him, yeah. I think the players are on side. They've had him before. Well, the majority of them, obviously.
Oh, I don't care about the details. I just want to know, were all the Luton squad on a Zoom call and then he just popped in on another window? That's all I care about.
I don't know. But yeah, he's back at the training ground and we're ready to survive. Do not relegate us, Max Rushton.
Yeah, sorry, bad luck.
You got your way with Peterborough. You're not having your way with us.
All right, look, that'll do for part one. Ali, great performance, but I'm subbing you for Susie Rack. Thanks for your time.
I'm done. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Ali. Susie will join us for part two. We'll look at the future of the women's game. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Ali Maxwell is in the dressing room, threw his shirt on the floor. Susie Rack has come on. There was no high five because Ali was so furious. But Susie, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. I suspect some of the conversations that we're about to have about the women's game will echo what we've been talking about from the EFL. Paul Hayward wrote, I thought, a really good article in The Telegraph a few weeks ago, where he said, trying to save men's football but not women's too is not really saving football at all. The rise of women's football must not be stunted by the absurd economics of the men's game. Susie, how would you describe the state of the women's game right now?
I mean, to say it's been put on the back burner is probably a little bit of an understatement. We're about to go 7 months, potentially, with no women's football at all. Maybe the Champions League in late August, if we're lucky. It's hard to say that football is being saved when women's football has been so spectacularly shut down. I get all the arguments that, oh, well, it's not the whole of men's football that's coming back. It's just the Premier League. It's just the very top. It's because of the money involved. It's because of the broadcast deals. But when you look at countries like Germany and the US, who are finding ways to play and being quite innovative, it's frustrating not to see just a little bit more creativity to the thinking on the FA's part. That's the biggest thing for me, is just a lack of any willingness really to think outside the box. And for me, that's partly because the FA has so many other responsibilities that women's football doesn't necessarily take kind of top priority. And that's right, but also means you just don't get bold thinking because they can't, you know, kind of be brilliant at women's football and then not be brilliant at other aspects of the game.
The Italian FA is releasing money for their women's teams. The French FA is doing it as well. Why are they doing it and the English FA not doing it? Is it a will? Is it like you say, other responsibilities? Is it they don't care?
I think it's like just a different culture to the way football is run in those countries compared to here. I think generally in some of the big European countries, obviously particularly Germany, there's a much more inclusiveness and slightly more socialised running to football. Here it's so driven by the Premier League, so driven by money, that even just the idea that you would possibly help out the poorer clubs at the expense of the richer clubs is just, like, seems completely utopian. Whereas in other countries, that's a completely normal thing to do. And I think that is a cultural thing. I think that is a cultural thing in terms of how kind of governing bodies operate and how football operates in those countries. Ties to politics as well, because obviously, like, football is semi-reflective of the politics of the time and what's going on in society more generally. And obviously, at the moment, you know, we've seen the worst handling of the coronavirus crisis across Europe here. So it doesn't kind of surprise me that we're then seeing the worst handling of women's football here as opposed to everywhere else, because it sort of mirrors the decision making.
I echo completely what Susie says, and I think there's just a real lack of transparency. When you look at the Premier League and the EFL, whether it was through leaks or through, you know, their own communications, it was very clear, you know, we're doing this, we're discussing with this, we're doing this, we're doing this. With the WSL and the Championship, there was always just a, you know, the consultation continues. And, you know, from my understanding, there were players and coaches who did feel like it was unsafe. And obviously with, you know, leagues with far fewer teams in them, you know, those concerns are more powerful than, say, the Premier League and the Championship, where if a couple of players have concerns, you know, you can either play or you don't, you know, it's still going to happen without you. So obviously those players have a bit more power in those leagues. But at the same time, the reality is if it's safe enough for men to play football, it's safe enough for women to play football. And the decision was, you know, packaged up as a safety decision, when actually, when the reality, when you look at it, it's really a financial decision. You know, the costing of testing and the risk, as it were, you know, two sides to it. The women's football broadcast rights are not worth anything. And then the second element is women's clubs bring in a big chunk of revenue through ticketing. So if you can't have fans and you've not got the broadcast rights at risk, then almost what's the point? And at the same time, you know, women are far less likely to be impacted as heavy from coronavirus. So if anything, you know, what the scientific findings more broadly have shown is that actually they would have a better chance of playing than the men's clubs. But I think there was just so many angles to it that I felt like they sort of muddied the waters a little bit. And I know, you know, Susie in her piece talked about how the German FA had lent on the bigger clubs to help the cost of testing. Perhaps the FA did ask the Premier League to help out with finances, but they didn't tell us that. You're not saying we need someone to blame, but at the same time, it's just about being transparent and just about saying, you know, this is what we're trying to do and we can't do it for financial reasons. But I think to package it up as a safety decision, it just didn't feel really true and honest. And I felt like there was more kind of the reasons behind it. And if you don't let those facts all come to the surface, then people are going to make their own minds up, whether that's through the media or fans, because people were pretty cheesed off.
I feel like it was a bit of a resignation, actually. I feel like they almost sat back and accepted it and said it was fine. There wasn't a lot of fight. And that surprised me, bearing in mind how much of a fight there's been for how many years, and that we were actually, women's football was starting to get somewhere and we were getting progress. It was an interesting conversation we had. I think you were on the call, Susie, as well, with Gavin Makel, head of women's football at Manchester City. And he was asked whether he felt as if it was an opportunity missed. And he said no, because women's football is going to have many more opportunities in the future. And I thought, yeah, but, you know, seize it now while there's a focus and attention on it. I don't understand why you wouldn't. And I just wonder whether there is just a bit more of a strategic plan in place that, again, as Flo says, we're just not aware of, because they seem to not want to release too much information about what they want to do in the future, and they drip feed things. And if that's the case, I really want to know what that strategy is. I want to know what the plan is, as do a lot of other people, because they're going to start to lose that momentum. As Susie said, 7 months with no women's football after exactly what we had in the summer, which was that massive momentum shift. We're now not going to have a women's Euros at home in England in 2021. That's now 2022. We will get the Olympics, but there's a lot of other focus on the Olympics. It's not solely on women's football. So, you know, I personally felt as if it was an opportunity missed and that there wasn't enough of a struggle to put it, you know, front page.
I also think, you know, lots of people have talked about the impact on kind of the general growth of women's football, which I don't think is such a big negative impact. I think the biggest impact is the fact that, you know, the competitiveness of the WSL is really going to suffer, because like we're seeing with the Championship, League One, League Two, where the richest clubs are going to survive this crisis, we're going to see exactly the same in the WSL. The gap is going to get even bigger now, because clubs like Chelsea and Arsenal and Man City are going to be so much richer than everyone else because they survived this, you know, without even a scratch, where the other clubs are going to be fighting to try and, you know, stay relevant and stay competitive. And then, like we talked about earlier with League One, League Two and the National League, if they come back with no fans, that's an even bigger loss for the clubs that need it most. So I think women's football will recover in the sense of, I think the game will continue to grow as soon as women's grassroots football can come back. And that's something that we haven't really talked about that much either, because like men's grassroots football is, if the grassroots sport can't return either, then we're losing a massive gap. But I think the competitiveness of the league is really at threat here, because the bigger clubs are just going to get even stronger.
So does it just come down, the success of the top teams, to whether that club cares about women's football? Is it that simple?
Pretty much. I mean, I do wonder, and this is the slight cynic in me, and, you know, feel free to shout this argument down completely, but you do wonder whether they would have taken the decision to promote Aston Villa, who was 6 points clear at the top of the Women's Championship, had they not had a WSL-ready club, if you like, had they not had the investment from the owner, Christian Perslow, into women's football, if it was one of the smaller, in inverted commas, clubs in the Championship, would that have happened, or would they have just null and voided? And you know, I question that. I don't know whether that's, you know, I'm just being very cynical, but.
No, I think I agree with you, Faye. I think, you know, it's easier to do when you know there's a club that's going to qualify for the licence and there's going to be no questions asked. And also, when they null and voided the National League, the Women's National League below the Championship, they did that because they thought the Championship and WSL were going to continue. Now, obviously, that you know, the whole situation there comes into debate again, because no one's been relegated to the Championship, so no one can get promoted to the National League. And there's people there who are basically on season-long unbeaten streaks who are now stuck going nowhere. So I think there's a real frustration. And I think the FA are going to need to, you know, build people's trust up again, I think is a real thing, because I think women's football was in a very good place in terms of grassroots and professional. And I think some of that trust has been lost a little bit. And, we'll hopefully regain that when the season can start again.
Chelsea won the WSL, but it was ridiculously close. City a point ahead of Chelsea when the season was suspended, but played a game more. Did Chelsea deserve it, Susie?
If I'm being completely frank, I think no. They haven't played every team in the league yet, which for me is like the baseline of what you should have done to be awarded a league title, is have played every single team in the league. They've not played Everton, who, you know, Everton have been doing phenomenally well this season, and that's a big game to have not played, either home or away. 71-72% of games played in the WSL, 69% of games played in the Championship. When you've only got 12 or 11 teams in a league, you can't really determine it with so few games played. It's really, really difficult to ascribe a league winner and a relegation place on the basis of so few points, because this is a league that could be, Emma Hayes has said it, Joe Montemurro has said it, Nick Cushing had said it previously when he was at City, like this is a league that could be won or lost on a single game. And so like the idea that you then kind of determined it early for me doesn't really work. I think they should have null and voided it like they did the rest of the pyramid personally, but I can understand why they've had to, you know, the pressure from UEFA to pick Champions League spots and things like that has meant they've sort of kind of had to come up with a sporting decision, but I don't think it's very fair. And I'm not necessarily sure that you should award relegation and promotion on the basis of it. You could determine the table as such, but I think to declare a team champions is pretty woolly. It's great that Chelsea have given the money away to domestic abuse charities, so I thought that was, you know, giving it to Refuge, the first ever prize pot for the Women's Super League as a result of the Barclays sponsorship. They've given the 100 grand to Refuge. I think that's great, but again, like a little bit of a meaningless trophy.
We talk about you know, whether individual clubs care about the women's game or not. And it seems so strange that, and I know you've talked about Liverpool before, just the disparity between the fact the men's team almost can do no wrong on the pitch, off the pitch. You know, they've got all these sort of heroes. Jurgen Klopp, everybody loves Jurgen. James Milner's such a hero that their women's team, and it wouldn't require that much funding. I mean, you all know more than me, for them to make much more of a fist of their women's side, Flo.
Yeah, it's funny because I know someone on Twitter, when Max, you put out your tweet saying that I was coming on, said, oh great, Flo's coming on to moan about Liverpool's women's team again. So Dave, or whatever your name was, here you go, this one's for you. You know what's really frustrating is the fact that all, you know, the players that have left the club in the last couple of weeks, and this is very common in women's football because, you know, there are players have signed on to 1-2 year contracts. So there's often a massive exodus in the summer before new players start coming in. And pretty much every single player who put out, you know, a notes app or some other statement on social media said, I just want to fall in love with football again. And I find that really depressing. I find that the fact that, you know, you were supposed to be employing full-time athletes, yet they were barely playing football, and you're a multi-million pound international company, effectively. And not only that, is Liverpool's statement, and this is what frustrates me about women's football, is Liverpool's statement, you know, only really mention the fact that they're committed to growing the women's game in England. But, you know, forget just growing the women's game. What about the professional athletes that you're employing? You know, women's football is not just a charitable enterprise. It's not just about, you know, growing the game. We never ask men's footballers about their responsibility to grow the sport. We talk about it as a sport, as a product, as an entertainment prospect. Yet, you know, we often hold up women's football as this kind of, like, beacon of, you know, inspiration that always has to be shining bright for everyone to see. You know, at the end of the day, these are professional athletes. This is a sport. This is entertainment too. And the fact that you're letting down these women who are supposed to be full-time athletes is completely embarrassing. And, you know, don't just say that you're committed to growing women's football. Commit to supporting women to play football as a professional, because, you know, I feel sorry for Vicky Jepson. She's a fantastic coach, and I think she's been completely let down and hung out to dry by a club that don't care at all about their women's team. And I think that's the only pro for me about the way the situation has been handled with relegation, is I just hope it gives Liverpool a kick up the arse, because they need to get their shit together, basically.
Yeah, I've seen a few people say that that Liverpool's relegation is the fault of the management, that they've made some poor decisions, that signed a few wrong players and things like that. But why is Vicky in that position? You know, a really good coach that came up from the academy and stepped into this job because Neil Redfern left one, two games into the season, when, you know, everything he was promised sort of fell apart around him, and he realised that this just wasn't being taken seriously at all. She stepped into the breach. She should never have even been in that job in the first place. As much as I think, you know, she is a very, very good manager and deserves a shot at managing at the top at some stage in her career, whether that be now or in the future. She would, like, if Liverpool was serious about challenging at the top of the table and investing properly in the women's team, she wouldn't have ever been in there. Like, they wouldn't have had to have put her in that position, because Neil Redfern would have still been there, or Scott Rogers would have held the dressing room longer, because he wasn't having to, you know, kind of do this little juggling act of managing expectations with reality. And so that, for me, like, the idea that yes, they've not played the best at times, they've not managed to score at times, or some of the recruitment decisions haven't been the best. I also heard that they were only allowed to recruit 3 players in the summer last year, and that 2 of them were the manager's choice and the other one was picked for her. Like, it's woefully incompetent in comparison to the way they run the men's team.
Should that detract from the achievements of their men's team?
I think it should. I really think it should. Like if I was a Liverpool fan, I would be... Obviously, that trophy means so much, and, like, they've wanted it for so long, but how can you possibly, as a football fan that says this means more and you'll never walk alone, and parrots, like, the the working class roots of the club above anything else. How can you truly feel that and celebrate this trophy when you've got your women's team relegated on a third of the turnover of some of the biggest clubs in the women's game, a budget more similar to the likes of Bristol City and Birmingham and things like that, clubs who don't have any money? Like, how can you seriously enjoy that trophy and all it represents and what your club represents when it's so kind of undermined by the treatment of women on your payroll? I just for me, it has to tarnish it a little bit. You know, there's plenty of people when I tweeted that out that came back and said, haha, we don't care, it's not going to affect it at all. And like, I mean, that says more about those fans than it does about the club generally. I think if most fans give a damn about women in their lives in some form and want some kind of fairness for them, and if you're a decent football fan, like, you want your women's team to be paid on professional full-time contracts in the way that they're supposed to be in a so-called professional full-time league, and you want them to be challenging, like, the idea that you kind of completely undermine them from start to finish to the point at which they get relegated has to tarnish that trophy.
We talked in part one about League One and League Two clubs surviving. How worried are you about women's teams folding?
Well, I mean, we've already seen AFC filed, disband and then rebound, put the band back together. How do you say that? So, yeah, it is a genuine worry, as it is across the football pyramid. It is a worry. It's going to happen because everybody is going to be tightening their purse strings. So everybody, where clubs do invest in women's teams, they're not going to be able to invest as much money, you know. But I think the kind of community money, if you like, has to be ring fenced. Women's football money has to be ring fenced and protected, because it's just as important.
I think we're not going to see budgets go up at all, basically. That, for me, that's the issue. What we're going to see is, we're going to see most clubs survive, but the budgets are going to stagnate or be cut. So Fylde have come back, but they've come back at what, 70% less of their budget or something ridiculous like that. And I think we're going to see more situations like that. We're going to see, even at the very top clubs, the level of investment that they were planning is probably going to be slightly less. And then the further down you go, the bigger those budget cuts are going to be. So for me, that's the biggest issue, is the growth that has been accelerating at pace and the investment that's been put in increasingly high levels is going to just stall slightly, and we're just going to kind of peter along for a bit at a much, much lower base level of financial investment.
I think a big worry is the sponsorship as well, because, you know, it was already a struggle to get sponsorship within women's football and get, you know, money on board. But of course, you know, big brands are now going to be reining in their own budgets, and, you know, if it was already low down on the pecking order, it's going to be pushed even further down, and that's going to be a big problem.
Susie, I want to ask you about your interview with Anson Dorrance. We talked about him when we look back at that 1991 Women's World Cup final. He managed the US women's team there, and he's still coaching now. And he said this really interesting thing. The biggest challenge, honestly, when you go from coaching men to coaching women, is that we raise our girls and young women to not be competitive. Society conditions them not to be. So what the heck's going on where you're a competitive woman and you're excoriated, and if you're a competitive male, you're basically put on a pedestal? Obviously, I don't know if you were all brought up to not be competitive, or, you know, Flo, you're younger, if it's changed over time, I don't know. But I just found that such an interesting thing that I sort of hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah, firstly, when I spoke to him, he is absolutely awesome. He's just like the most personable guy to chat to. That issue of competitiveness, he's mainly talking about how bad it was when he started coaching women, which was in the 70s, the early 70s. So that was at a time in the States when Title IX, the legislation that basically decreed that all education institutes had to fund men and women's sport equally, so saw a massive boost in spending on women's sport to match men's at college level and in high schools and stuff. That legislation was just coming in, so there's been a big shift in women's sport around that time, and particularly around then, it was a lot worse. You know, girls were girls, and you were prim and proper, and you did your schoolwork, and you were good and placid, and and not competitive, and any kind of competitive sport in Edge was frowned upon, and that still resonates today in a lot of senses. It's a lot better now. You know, we can play sport, we can be competitive. It's you know, you get the big ad campaigns from like Women in Sport and stuff that show women being sweaty and being physically strong, and the spreads in newspapers of, you know, the like sporting body type stuff of strong physical athletic women that is much more celebrated. But there is still this kind of underlying attitude that's not necessarily a place for women, even if it's not as bad as it was then. But yeah, Dorrance is absolutely fascinating guy. He's got a couple of really, really good books as well, because he crafted this winning mentality of the US women's national team through what he called the competitive cauldron, which is basically building competitiveness within women athletes that he coached by basically ranking them and pinning it on the wall. Every single week, their ranks across 28 different categories would be pinned on the wall for everyone in the university to see. And you moved up and down those rankings each week, and where you were at the end of the year determines sort of, you know, your future at the university to a certain extent. If you finished in the top three of those, the likelihood of you then going on at some stage to play for the US women's national team, despite that being, you know, a few rungs below ever being at that stage, was extremely high. He's coached one in three, I think, of every US women's national team World Cup winners. So his success record is just extraordinary, even if the methods seem somewhat like extreme at times.
It was a fascinating interview. I tweeted out yesterday, so go and have a look at it. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up with any other business. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Premier League returns on Wednesday. We'll discuss it on tomorrow's pod, and we'll salute Marcus Rashford as well tomorrow. In La Liga, wins for Barcelona. Messi was good, and La Liga says it'll take legal action after a pitch invader breached security to get a selfie with Messi at a behind-closed-doors game, which is quite impressive. Real Madrid won as well. Toni Kroos scored a lovely goal. Marcelo took the knee when he scored as well. Sevilla, the only team from the chasing pack to win. Callum says, fake stadium noises and cardboard cutouts in stands. Do we like or dislike? Now, I definitely thought I would be against this, but I was watching Real Madrid last night and they had a sort of CGI crowd and they had the crowd noises. And I'm all in favour. Does this make me a terrible person, Flo?
No, I definitely like the fake crowd noises. I was the same. I thought fake crowd noises were a bit cringe, but actually it makes such a difference. It's quite nice not being able to hear the players kind of like swear at each other. It's quite nice. So I'm all for it. And I like it where, you know, you can, the fans can kind of pick who they want to be on the cardboard cutout. So I know in rugby league in Australia, there's been some interesting choices, shall we say, of who cardboard cutouts.
Some serial killers. Yeah. I think that's where the line stops. Yeah. Sid Lowe tweeting yesterday, someone at the telly just pressed the fan noise button that says cheer goal as the ball went wide. I want more of that. I'm desperate for Sky to, you know, pipe in just someone swearing and then having the commentators apologise for the swearing afterwards. Graham says, I liked it at the Bayern Borussia Mönchengladbach game yesterday, particularly when the piped boos and whistles after Gladbach had a goal disallowed by VAR. Bayern and Dortmund won both with late goals at the weekend. Archie very keen to let everyone know that Klaus Jazula, Paderborn's big Albanian, who wears a big grey felt hat, got his 17th booking of the season, a German record, and a European record at the moment. Roberto Soldado has 12 in Spain. Jorginho, 12 in the Premier League. I didn't have either of those two being the record breakers. Jack says, Messi scored a deflected goal while Ronaldo missed a penalty. Definitive proof, finally, surely at last, that Messi is better than Ronaldo. Ronaldo missed in the Coppa Italia, but Juve still threw after that penalty miss. They'll play Napoli, who edged out into the finals on Wednesday. Question from Big Papa Steve. He says, with the Scottish Premiership finished, five substitutes and an enlarged bench. Should Steven Gerrard come out of retirement, sign for Liverpool and get his five appearances for a Premier League title? I am absolutely 100% in favour of that. Susie, would you like to see that? Despite your criticism of Liverpool, would you accept Steven Gerrard coming back for that?
I sort of love it. It's very John Terry pulling on his kit, isn't it? Like, it's that level of Bantz.
But if they win two, he could start. He could play 90 minutes in seven games, couldn't he? That would surely be... it's wonderful to see. I'm sure somebody would question, you know, the credibility of the league. Why don't we finish with this question from Jack, which says, if Barry needed a place to stay, how long would each of the guests let him sleep on their sofa rent-free before kicking him out? Faye.
I think the question should be, would you even let him stay on your sofa?
You're saying naught. Are you saying naught days? You're starting at zero, are you, Faye?
Yes.
Any advances on naught? Not more, no. Would you let him in for a cup of tea? Naught minutes?
I'd let him in for a glass of water and a pee, and that's it.
Right, okay. Is anyone offering him any more sustenance than water? Susie?
We've got a spare room, so like I might let him stay up there, like in the attic for a little bit, and then emerge after a week or something and shove him out the door.
It's like one of those, we don't talk about the man in the spare room.
The ghost in the attic.
Oh, well, he'll be delighted to hear that he is loved across the board here. Thanks so much for your time. Thanks, Flo.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Faye.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Susie.
Cheers, Max.
And we'll be back tomorrow. The Life and Times of Jonathan Liu. Barry returns as well. And we'll be back on Tuesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.